This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to this episode of New Books in Latin American Studies. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Courtney J. Campbell about her new book, Region Out of Place, The Brazilian Northeast and the World, 1924 to 1968, just out with the University of Pittsburgh Press in 2022 here. Courtney Campbell is Associate Professor of Latin American History at the University of Birmingham in the UK. This book of hers stems from her PhD research at Vanderbilt University, which in turn is based on her ME research at the Universidad Federal de Pernambuco in Recife, where she lived for about 6 years, former Peace Corps volunteer in Paraguay in the early 2000s. She did her undergraduate work in languages, BA in Spanish, minor in international studies, BA in French at the University of Michigan, Flint. Most of her writing focuses on social and cultural history of 19th and 20th century Brazil. She's currently working on a couple of new projects that I'll ask her to tell us about by way of conclusion at the end. I'd also like to mention she's co-editor of the 2019 volume Empty Spaces, Perspectives on Emptiness in Modern History. Dr. Campbell, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a real honor to be here.
I wonder if we could begin by you telling us a little about the origins of this book, Region Out of Place, and just kind of what led you to researching the history of the Brazilian Northeast, this important region, and asking these particular questions.
Sure. It's a bit of a long story. And so I'm going to try to give you the short version. I lived in Brazil, in Recife, for several years. And during that time, I did some postgraduate study and I taught English. I studied education while I was in Brazil. And initially, that was through a one-year specialization course that was more focused on pedagogy. But for my master's, I was accepted into the Center for Education of the Federal University of Pernambuco, as you mentioned, in Recife, which I kind of outside of that area would be better known as the Paulo Freire Center. So it was a real enormous honor to be there. There was a real rigorous application process, and my Portuguese was still getting better, let's put it that way. So I was really nervous about it. And I had the great luck to work with Professor Flavio Braina while I was there. He supervised my dissertation research. And I worked while I was doing that dissertation research. It was on the history of the teaching of English in Recife. I was measuring that history against this concept of linguistic imperialism. So at that time, it was really kind of combining my two activities in Brazil, that I lived in Brazil, that I was teaching, and I was teaching English, and I was interested in the region. When I applied to PhD programs in the US, I had initially intended to expand that project and look more broadly at U.S. cultural influence in the Northeast of Brazil. But it's kind of a funny thing. When I was there in Brazil, in Recife, my interest was in how U.S. culture was imported and consumed in the region. But when I left, my interest kind of shifted to look more at the region itself and how people within the Northeast chose to participate in different interactions with various peoples and cultures and not limiting it anymore to just the United States and U.S. influence. I did my PhD at Vanderbilt University under the supervision of Marshall Aiken and with a heavy dose of support from Celso Castillo, who also had spent a lot of time researching in Recife. And somewhere during that time, I can't remember precisely where, I read Duval Muniz de Albuquerque Jr.'s book, The Invention of the Northeast. And it was it really shifted my way and my perspective of looking at the history that I was interested in. His book, looking at the region and its identity as a discursive formation, right?
A book which you reference extensively here in your book.
Yes, yeah, it's a really influential book in all, you know, Brazilian history, but especially in looking at regional identity in Brazil. And I think it has implications that should really go much broader too. It was recently translated to English and published by Duke, if I remember correctly, with a foreword by James Green from Brown too. So it's an important book, and it really changed the way that I was looking at my own interests in the country. And Duval's book focuses on, you know, the development of regional identity and this idea that the Northeast was a recent formation. This isn't something that had existed in the 19th century. There was no Northeastern region. There was the vast North, right? And so he's looking at how the Northeast came into existence in that way. And my interest being international and how the international is involved in that, I came up with some, what I refer to as episodes in Northeastern history that I thought highlighted the kinds of international interaction that I'm interested in, aiming to get a sense of how ideas about the region were discussed and forged through these international events. I don't remember what the list of the initial events that I came up with were in my brainstorming, because to be honest, it really changed in my field work. When I went down to Brazil to do research, I applied for a Fulbright Hayes doctoral research fellowship, but Congress defunded it that year. Interesting times. Fortunately, the Mellon Foundation swooped in and decided to fund some or all, I'm not really sure, of the humanities candidates. And the Institute for International Education administered that with some support within Brazil from Fulbright Brazil still, who offered some administrative support too. So I was still able to do my research in Brazil despite Congress's bad decision. And that's where when most of the archival research for my book took place. I did research in 9 different states while I was there. I traveled through the Brazilian Northeast to make sure that the research I was doing wasn't just centered on Recife and Pernambuco. And I also went to some southern archives in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo as well. And during that research, the episodes changed, the timeline changed, my whole understanding of the phenomenon changed, to be honest. And that research is what led to my PhD thesis. And that thesis I then revised significantly for this book, particularly in a couple of chapters that I think that'll probably come out in the course of our conversation. And in many ways, you can then see that this book has been in process for a very, very long time.
Yes, indeed. And you spent 6 years, you said, living in Brazil, right? I mean, that's an important piece of it.
Absolutely. And then, of course, you know, I went back during my PhD studies. I went back every summer to do research, and I spent that other year doing field work there too. So it was definitely a long time coming.
We're going to go through some of these episodes that you mentioned that are highlighted in the book, because they're really fascinating and unique. And I think they bring in a lot of historical actors that people other than Brazilianists or people familiar with Brazil will indeed recognize here. This contribution, it seems to me, Courtney, region out of place as a contribution to Latin American historiography is important in a couple of ways. And you've talked about some of it, I think, but it's especially in moving beyond nation as a kind of default scale or framework for the way we do research and think about the Americas more broadly. And this seems to be a really clear articulation, fresh conceptualization of region in Latin America laid out in the book's introduction in a very effective way, and then illustrated with some of the episodes that you mentioned from the 20s through the 60s, and even referencing some other interesting recent, more recent developments. So if you could just tell us a little bit about, you know, the main thrust of the book and the main points you're trying to make, main arguments and contributions as you see them.
Thank you. Sure. I'll try to go broad first and narrow down to more specific. The book looks at the development of regional identity in the Brazilian Northeast. And it does so by examining how the region's inhabitants engaged in different international events. And some of those international events are in Brazil, some of them are abroad. But in each of them, in some way, there are Northeasterners participating. I try to look at a really broad cross-section of society. So the episodes or stories that we're looking at here range from intellectuals and cinematographers to fishermen, from young women that were dating U.S. soldiers to beauty queens. And in doing so, the book makes a few key points. The first is that the development of subnational regional identities was happening around the world as part of the development of national identities, that these two things are connected. And as the development of national identities is also tied to the development of notions of race and ethnicities, then so is the development of these subnational regional identities. That said, as you mentioned, regional identity wasn't limited to national borders, and it often is imagined as being so, right? That you have subnational regional identity, it fits within the nation, and that's it. But I think, especially in the case of the Brazilian Northeast, and I'm certain that this is true in other regions too, regional identity was forged with both national and international spheres and interactions in mind. Importantly then, or maybe even essentially, these regional identities might have been pushed as stereotypes coming from the nation, from the national scale, or described by regional intellectuals, or even promoted by regional intellectuals, but they weren't owned by the state, they weren't owned by the center of the nation, and they weren't owned by intellectuals. The working poor, the drought-stricken migrant, the beauty queen, the local press, a popular poet singing in a city square, teachers trying to teach adults how to read so that they could vote, they all took part in this process of developing a regional identity in the Brazilian Northeast. And they all did so aware that the region was also interacting with the world and often skipping over the national scale purposefully in order to get their story out there to be heard. I use this framing then of stepping out of place, the title being Region Out of Place. I use the framing of stepping out of place to understand both of these transgressions, that the region is stepping out of the place within the nation that it's expected to be in. It's disrupting that spatial hierarchy that we assume by stepping into the international sphere. And that the Northeasterner, particularly the poor Black and mixed race Northeasterner, steps out of the social space expected for them as well, also engaging internationally. And I believe there are implications here for understanding not only region, but nation, when we talk about culture and the development of cultural identities here, in that perhaps the nation too needs to be understood as a very limited metaphor for that imagined community that Benedict Anderson told us about. The region isn't contained to the nation, but perhaps the nation isn't necessarily contained to itself either. Coming back specifically to the Northeast, this book is showing then in terms of cultural identity, by the late 1960s, we end up with this kind of grab bag full of characteristics that describe the Northeast, sometimes contradictorily, that they're used to describe and understand it, and from which people can kind of pull depending on what we are talking about, who we are talking to, and for what purposes. Someone could say the Northeast is poor and underdeveloped, or that the Northeast is vibrant and culturally rich, that it's backwards and in need of state intervention, or in need of international aid, or that it's the real authentic Brazilian culture. It's where the North, where Brazilian culture was born and where it resides, where it needs to be protected from outside influence. But then again, in other ways of understanding it, the Northeast is rebellious, violent even, and needs protection from no one at all. But all of these ideas were forged by crossing various geographic scales from local, regional, national, international, and importantly, by disregarding any kind of geographic hierarchy at all within that.
Could you orient those of us not familiar with the geography? I mean, Brazil itself, the national territory is enormous, of course, in relation to what all the other nations of Latin America. What cities, for instance, Recife and Pernambuco, right, are in the northeastern region, correct?
Yeah, so Brazil is understood as being divided into several regions, as most countries are, right? You have the northern region where you have the Amazon and such. You have next to it then the northeast, which isn't necessarily always to the north or to the east, but whatever. You have the south and the southeast, the center west, and these regions, the idea about their borders and what is contained within them, what isn't contained within them, has also changed over time. So these are not static. They change. There will be people who still will say that Bahia is not of the Northeast, because they were born in a time when Bahia wasn't considered part of the Northeast. And others who will firmly consider Bahia to be the Northeast, for example. So these aren't static geographic designations. But how it's generally understood is that the Northeast currently contains 9 states.
But then, I mean, just by noting that there's 9 states and the vastness of the territory of what's considered the Northeast, I mean, we should understand that it's just a heterogeneous and diverse region, right? So that's part of what enables all of these projections in terms of Northeastern identity that are across the spectrum, right? From rebellious to backward to the other things that you mentioned.
Absolutely. And each of these different states have their own state identities within that regional identity, and which are often in conflict with the other states within the Northeast. So there isn't necessarily even agreement within the Northeast of what Northeastern regional identity is. And so it's very much multivalent and varied. So in the main cities you'd ask for example, in Fortaleza, in Ceará, the idea of what it means to be Northeastern is very different than what it would be in Recife, in Pernambuco, in Salvador, in Bahia, in João Pessoa, in Paraíba, in Natal, in Rio Grande do Norte. So it's very much a heterogeneous, culturally rich place that is also a very large territory.
Yes. I think chapter 1 provides some really important background for us in terms of talking about the history of drought in the Northeast, and then also migration, you know, either as a result of drought conditions and all that came with it, or for other reasons. Could you talk a little bit about drought and migration, and then introduce us, Courtney, to Cordell literature, which is an important source for your book here?
Sure. So the Northeast is known as being a place that's defined as drought. And in fact, it was drought that initially defined the region, which is a point that Duval Muniz de Albuquerque Jr. made very well in his work. There were recurrent droughts in the Northeast, in what is now known as the Northeast, that was once just known as the drought region. And some of them were absolutely devastating, droughts towards the end of the 19th century, in which that coincided with smallpox, for example, and ended up devastating a large amount of the population, particularly the enslaved. And with the birth of the nation, with the declaration of the Proclamation of the Republic in 1889, when Brazil stopped being an empire and became a republic, it became important to modernize the nation, right? To become a modern nation, and that means one that can face the world with a certain level of pride as well. So it became important to tackle these problematic regions, these problems in the region, drought being the primary problem. So several institutions and agencies were created at the federal level to try to deal with the drought to varying levels of success. And they were never going to be very successful because they were focused on responding to a phenomenon that will always recur. It's part of the geography of the region. It's part of the geography of the world. So you're not going to change the drought. You have to learn to deal with it. And
I'm sorry. I was just going to say that because droughts there go back to, I mean, as long as we have records, basically, right? I mean, you've got a table in chapter one that shows from 1559 to 1966 the recurrence of drought years, basically.
Yeah, absolutely, and they're part and parcel of a like I said, winds and such around the world that are influenced by things like El Nino and other effects. So, they are recurring. They are part of the geography, the climate of the region. But because the politics, the policies put in place to deal with the drought weren't focused on helping the poor, right? That were actually devastated routinely by the drought. And so along with these kind of recurrent droughts, you also get recurrent migration in the region from the backlands, which is referred to as the sertão. So from the backlands out to the coast. So often this migration took place within the same state, or at least within the same region, going to the more coastal cities, or it went from the Northeast to the Amazon, or from the Northeast down to the South or Southeast, where the migrant would then go to find work and either send money home and return later or stay permanently. Many of these migrants took with them a popular Northeastern literary genre referred to as cordel literature. Cordel is basically a kind of poetry that is very democratic in the sense that all you need to do it is some kind of printing press or typewriter and one piece of paper. It is eight pages. It's one piece of paper that's folded into quarters and then cut so that you have eight pages. And it tends to follow one of two different rhyme schemes. So it's very... it's easy to know what you're expecting out of the rhyme scheme. And it historically was read out loud. So either read out loud in squares or read out loud to other people. And this, of course, helped to make it easier for non-literate populations to also have access to this popular genre. And of cordel literature, it covers everything. You'll find in cordel literature explanations of Galileo's discoveries. You'll find campaigns against or campaigns for safe sex. You'll find, but most of the topics have to do with the Northeast and what Northeasterners deal with in different ways. Some in very fictional ways. Some in non-fictional ways. And a big chunk of that genre then is migrant literature. That is the migrant Northeasterner writing about their experience as a migrant. And that is what this first chapter focuses on, and the second and the latter half of the chapter. It focuses on that art by Northeastern migrants and how the migrants went with this thought that they were going to, you know, go to another Brazil, another part of Brazil, but in the end found that they were going essentially to a foreign country and that they were foreigners in that country. They didn't dress the same. They didn't talk the same. They were treated poorly. They were treated as if they were foreigners, as if they weren't real Brazilians. And so this chapter is framed in a way that is meant to show that the first contact with the other, with the foreigner, with the more cosmopolitan person was actually within Brazil in that sense.
And what were some of the common tropes that you found in narratives about migration in that popular literature?
They focused...
Like the Exodus. I noticed the Exodus as the biblical reference as one.
Yes, the way and the whole arduous migration, right? The vehicles that were used, the difficulties involved. One of the tropes was being fooled. There was a lot of we were told that we would do this, but instead we were forced into this. There's some a trope of forced migration and escape. There's also a common trope about saudade, about missing the Northeast, about longing for this region. And in these kind of lists of things that the authors put of what they missed about the region, they're also defining what the region is. So they list the foods that they miss, the events that they miss, rodeos and cattle roundups and different saints festivals that are commonly celebrated in the Northeast, like São João, different foods, different music, different dances. And in doing so, they're really defining what Northeastern culture is in contrast to what they're finding in the South and Southeast. Another trope is of return and of how upon return, many of them felt that they had to hide. They had to hide what their experience was in the South and Southeast in order to not feel foolish. And in doing so, other Cordelistas, other Cordel writers say that they fooled others into thinking that it was, you know, everything is great. Go to the South, Southeast. They talk a lot about their clothing and as I mentioned, about talking differently, about how their speech is different too.
Tell us a little bit about the well-known Brazilian sociologist Gilberto Freire and his role in the formation of Northeastern cultural identity and kind of defining the Northeast as a region. And just his role in thinking about and creating networks to think about regionalism.
So Gilberto Freire was from Recife, and he was educated initially in a Baptist the American Baptist School, it was called, and so a lot of the teaching was in English, and they forged ties with Baylor University in Texas. Gilberto Freire then became incredibly mobile. He did some studies at Baylor. He also went to Columbia and did studies with famous anthropologists. He spent some time touring Europe and meeting other regionalists in Europe. And so while he was away, he started in much the same way that the Cordelistas do. You go away and you start reflecting on your home, your hometown, your place of origin, and feel like you get a better understanding of it, right? So he starts writing for the Diário de Pernambuco, a famous newspaper, long-running newspaper in Pernambuco, about the Northeast and its regional identity and about his travels. When he comes back to Recife, he joins some other intellectuals, regionalist intellectuals, in starting a regionalist center in Recife and also in organizing a regionalist conference. And at that regionalist conference, he invites people that he had met during his travels. There are roundtables on food, on dance, on literature, on politics. It was a very dynamic conference taking place in 1926 in Recife. And they really start to set into intellectual terms what the Northeast is. And they're really doing so against that initial definition that the region is only drought, suffering, migration. And then they're saying, but it's so much more. This is what our identity is. So very early on, we see the development of a cultural identity coming out through these regionalists, the most important of which arguably was Gilberto Freire. Early on in that, the earliest mentions that we have of the Northeast as a region is around 1919, 1920. So for them to already be forming this in 1926 to say the region is so much more than just this geography is really significant. Freire also writes a manifesto referred to as the Regionalist Manifesto. And there's a whole debate about when it was written. He says it was written in 1926, but it wasn't published until 1954. So one can assume that there was much revision that took place in that time. But in many ways, this Regionalist Manifesto is kind of a product of a mixture of many of his writings in that time. It presents the region as a cultural identity, as defined by foods, which is important. He makes a point of pointing out that it is women that are making these foods. So he also genders the region to a certain extent. He refers to the work that goes into creating culture and art and working the land. And he makes sure to mention race and the different categories of people who are working it. And so he offers up this racialized and gendered view of the Northeastern region and its identity. But he also places this within a really broad global regionalist movement, as he refers to it. So there was what he calls a regionalist conference in Charlottesville, which was actually, it was a regionalist roundtable within another conference, but still. He refers to this and the intellectuals in the United States that had been working on race and region.
Is it Charlottesville, Virginia?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
At the University of Virginia, in fact.
Yes.
He refers to different French intellectuals like Charles Maurras. He refers to Scandinavian intellectuals working on region or that create regional art. He makes a point of saying this isn't just about Brazil or about the Northeast of Brazil. And he's doing so because he's clever and he knows that Brazilians really care, as many other people do, about what the world thinks of their nation. And so this, he wants to say, we're not lesser because we have this regional identity. We're part of a whole European and North American movement, right? That this is happening around the world. And he's not wrong. It was. That's part of the argument of my book. So it was in many ways taking place around the world at this time, these discussions of what subnational regions are and what their place is within the nation.
Yeah, because I tend to think of that period, you talk in the context of Freire 20s to 50s or so, as a kind of a high tide of nationalism around the world in a sense. But you're saying also, and as a key element of the construction of that, in many places at least, regionalism was central to it. How about the remarkable story of the four Brazilian fishermen from the northeastern region and their protest in 1941 that drew international attention, including Orson Welles? Could you tell us a little bit about the four fishermen and Orson Welles?
Yeah, this is such a great story. I love this story so much. Fishing is a trade along the northeastern coast, which shouldn't be surprising. And the fishermen along the northeastern coast, they use a specific type of sail raft. It's what we would understand as a raft of logs kind of lashed together with a sail. It's fairly rustic. It is referred to as a jangada, so they are called jangadeiros. And there's a tradition tied with them of a certain level of social activism. There were jangadeiros during abolitionism in Ceará that shut down a port that was supposed to transport enslaved Africans or Afro-Brazilians from the northeast down to the south, for example. And they also were associated with these great feats of distance, known as, they call them raids, which is raides, which is very much descended from the English term. But what they mean by that is how far can you go, right? So they kind of combine, these four fishermen combine these two ideas that are associated with them, and they decide to protest that the president of Brazil's new social and labor laws that are being put into place don't include them. Getúlio Vargas put in place, or his administration at least, put in place things like pensions, the right to pension, or the right to a minimum wage. And because the jangadeiros, their trade wasn't included as in the list of professions, they didn't have the right to these things. And they wanted to bring his attention to this. So they pulled together the resources. They planned this for a very long time. In fact, the leader of this feat, Jacare, as he was referred to, learned to read and write just to be able to write a letter to Vargas. And they set out from Fortaleza in the state of Ceará to make this point. And when they did, it was also, as luck would have it, right in the early days of the Associated Press in Brazil that was being formed. So the Associated Press picked up on the story and started publishing little snippets about every stop that they made. So they would make little stops along the way at the key cities, and there would be an article in all of the newspapers of the Associated Press in Brazil saying the four fishermen, the brave, stoic northeastern fishermen have arrived in such and such a city or town. Or the brave, stoic northeastern fishermen have not been heard from for days. Are they lost at sea? And they'd create this intrigue. And so initially, nobody really knew about them. But by the time before they left the Northeast, they already became these kind of national heroes. And people were following their story to the point that when they arrived in Rio de Janeiro to make their point, they were met with great fanfare. A lot of crowds came to meet them. Their jangada was carried down the street, and they donated it to the first lady, the Getúlio Vargas' wife. And they met with him on the street, face to face, surrounded by crowds. And Jacare spoke to him for an hour. I found this story so incredible. And they effectively changed the labor law. Now, there were things that didn't change, and they were still unsatisfied with it. They did try to do future raids in the future. But still, they made this massive change to labor law.
Was that a planned meeting, or did they just sort of find Vargas where he was at that day? And
No, by the time they got to Rio de Janeiro, things started to get really orchestrated. So they could have come into Rio de Janeiro earlier, for example, and they stayed at sea for a couple of days so that they could come in on a national holiday. So they really did, things became very media focused, right? Very public facing. And part of this media focus led to the New York Times publishing a very, not New York, was it New York? Yes, New York Times, and Life Magazine, Time Magazine, sorry, publishing a very short snippet about the raid and about the four fishermen. It was just called Four Men on a Raft. Very short little article that Orson Welles read while he was in New York and said, this is amazing. I want to include it in this movie that I'm making as part of a Good Neighbor project. Intercultural exchange between the United States and Brazil. Welles was making this film that had several chapters in it, and he decided that one of those chapters would be on Brazilian Carnival, and one of them would focus on this 1941 fisherman's raid. But he wanted to use the actual fishermen as actors. And with the Carnival chapter, he also wanted to use the actual artists and carnival goers as the actors. And this becomes problematic for several reasons. One of which is that Jacare dies during the filming. There is an accident when they were pulling the raft in a bay in Rio de Janeiro, and he falls off the raft and he's never seen again, which devastates Welles. It devastates everybody. And puts an end essentially to the filming. There is, but also that the fishermen were lauded as these amazing Brazilians, these resilient stoic Northeasterners, the example of what Brazilians should actually strive to during their journey from Ceará to Rio de Janeiro. But once they became Once they entered Hollywood and were to be projected on this international screen, then it was seen that they had stepped out of their place and that they shouldn't be doing that, that this isn't how we want the world to see us as these mixed race, poor, semi-literate or illiterate fishermen. So the Brazilian censorship agencies step in, the U.S., the RKO also starts to create obstacles, and the film was never actually finished. It was left without a soundtrack.
It's a remarkable story. You've got so much packed into this book. I hate to get you to jump around so much, but thinking about the World War II period, Cold War period in Brazil, especially early Cold War. What about the episode with Coca-Cola, women in the Brazilian Northeast, and U.S. soldiers in the region?
Sure. So the in World War II, Brazil offers up, it goes into an agreement with the United States that. The U.S. can put military bases along the northeastern coast, seeing this as a strategic for a couple of reasons, to block any potential invasion of Nazi Germany into Allied territories, and also because it is the shortest navigation point between the Americas and or between Latin America and Africa. So they put in several, the U.S. puts in several naval and air bases for the most part. There's a blimp base as well. And during this time, then you have a lot of young North Americans, U.S. Americans in the region, and most of them men. And so there are many stories of young women who dated, young Brazilian Northeastern women who were dating these U.S. soldiers, and all of the stories that go along with that of, you know, brawls between the soldiers and the locals, but also of the spread of venereal diseases like syphilis, and The narrative.
Why Coca-Cola?
Oh yes.
Girls.
So at that time, the only place that you could get Coca-Cola in Brazil was at the bases, and so the girls who dated the U.S. soldiers would be referred to as Coca-Cola girls. And this kind of came to be after the war, when the war ends and the soldiers go home and the Coca-Cola girls are left behind, abandoned, seen as abandoned. This becomes kind of a metaphor for understanding not only these girls, but the entire region that would give itself so easily to these U.S. American soldiers just to be fooled and left abandoned and alone. So it becomes a Coca-Cola girl becomes kind of a disparaging term. And even there's a carnival block that is made in which the men dress up as Coca-Cola girls with their names emblazoned on these bonnets in order to mock the girls who dated U.S. soldiers.
Thanks, Courtney. You have a chapter in the book about football, about soccer, specifically about the ideas about Northeastern regional identity and how those circulated in discussions of World Cup football.
Yeah, there was a World Cup match. The World Cup was hosted in Brazil in 1950, or rather Brazil hosted the World Cup in 1950. And so there were Northeasterners who rallied to get at least one match played in Recife. There was a whole movement behind it. They got Jules Rimet himself to come and visit and see where they could, what stadium they could use. And they did end up hosting one match at the Ilha do Retiro stadium between the U.S. and Chile. And ultimately, the point of this chapter is to show how these discussions were about the Northeast, that the Northeast deserves to show itself to the world as well, that they needed this opportunity to engage in this, to show the world what the Northeast has to offer, while there were also real serious points of embarrassment and worries that what the world would see wouldn't be positive. So this was very much framed as how do we get around the nation so that we can actually show the world what we have.
And then I really like throughout this book, Courtney, how you like, maybe it's in every chapter, but certainly it's in several of them, how you start and end many chapters with this kind of tight analysis of a particular source, like regional art about the World Cup and how that can tell us something about Northeastern identity. I just thought that's a really cool aspect of the book. I don't know if you want to say anything about that kind of source usage or analysis.
Sure. I mean, thank you for that. I think the regional art also gives the opportunity to show how these conversations and about the Northeast go beyond just that moment. So with, you know, the World War II moment, yes, I talk about the dating and the sex work and the marriages that come out of that moment of the soldiers and the Northeastern women. But it's really just as much about the art that comes out in the Cold War period that talks about that, right? So it's as much about the Cold War as it is about World War II. And with the case of the football chapter, I do the same thing, right? I talk about the 1950 World Cup and the discussions around it, the debates around it, how it was carried out. But we end on a discussion of art about the 1950s World Cup and beyond, and Cordel literature on the World Cup in Brazil, or Brazil in the World Cup, and how what's being discussed is, again, the Northeast on an international stage.
And you note how that, like the concluding sentence of that chapter on page 134, for instance, is, while Northeastern identity is defined by intentional intellectual definitions, its character comes to life in art, everyday discussions, and noisy debate. How about Miss Brazil, Miss Universe, and ideas of beauty, race, class, etc. In Northeast Brazil. And there was the 2017 Miss Brazil is the first, Northeastern Miss Brazil, who is also Black. And that's kind of how you start.
Yes. And she, Mona Lisa Alcantara is her name. She gives an interview. She talks about her position as a Black Northeastern woman and how that means that she is she suffers double discrimination. And I think her forthrightness about that does a serious service for Black women in the Northeast. This chapter is looking at Northeastern women who were Miss Brazils and went on to represent the nation then in the Miss Universe pageant. And it's most of the time is spent on Marta Rocha, who was Miss Brazil 1954. She was from Salvador da Bahia. And Marta is a blonde-haired, blue-eyed woman, a voluptuous blonde-haired, blue-eyed woman. And this becomes kind of part and parcel of the story. She was absolutely stunning. And she was sent on to Miss Universe with some debate about whether or not Brazil should be sending on a woman who looks more Brazilian. And I put that between scare quotes and a debate about what does that mean? What does a woman looking more Brazilian even mean? Should, or even more pointedly, should we have sent along a woman who seems more Bahian, meaning Afro-Brazilian? But during that time, it's also well known that a Black woman was not going to win Miss Universe in the United States of America. So Brazilians were sending along not only who they thought was beautiful, but who they thought might win in the United States, playing kind of a dangerous game of guessing what the preferences of another nation might be aesthetically. Marta Rocha was expected to actually win Miss Universe. All around, newspapers projected that she would win, and instead, Miriam Stevenson, who was Miss USA, won. And there are questions about why that was, all sorts of explanations of it. But a rumor was started. A Brazilian reporter later said it was him that started it, that the reason that Marta Rocha won or didn't win was that she didn't have symmetrical proportions. She was not 36, 24, 36, as Miriam Stevenson was. And instead, she was a little bit smaller on top and a little bit wider on the bottom. And this became referred to as the famous 2 inches, that is the 2 inches around the hips or around the butt, basically, that would be wrapped into understandings of Brazilian national identity, particularly Northeastern regional identity, of preferring women of a different body shape than what North Americans would like. But this then gets, you know, wrapped up into discussions in cordel literature, in newspapers about what Brazilian beauty is and whether or not they should be pandering to United States understandings of beauty as well.
Fascinating discussion there with continued relevance. I wanted to look at this tantalizing, because I would like for it to go on quite a bit longer. Tantalizing chapter 7 of the book, A Defiant Northeast, the Movimiento de Cultura Popular and Banditry. And there you talk about Paulo Freire and other key actors. Could you say something about in the relatively little time we have left about this important chapter 7 and Defiant Northeast?
Yes. So important to this chapter is understanding that the vote in Brazil was limited by literacy all the way up until 1988.
As in, there was in the U.S., you say literacy test of
exactly.
Some sort to make one eligible for voting.
Yes, you had to sign your name before a notary, and be able to demonstrate that you could read and write to get a voter's registration in Brazil throughout parts of the imperial period and all of the republican period up until the Constitution of 1988, with some very small exceptions that aren't worth going into right now. In the northeast of Brazil, illiteracy rates were shockingly high. They were around 60% in most parts of the northeast, which meant that most adults couldn't vote. A movement called the Movimento de Cultura Popular, or the Popular Culture Movement, was formed by a couple, Norma Porto Carreiro and Germano Coelho, who had spent some time also in France studying and had spent some time with a movement in France called Peuple et Culture, also focused on education as a social movement and as a way to shore up the strength of your culture. They came back to Recife and met with the socialist mayor, Miguel Reis, and formed a social movement that was intended to carry out all sorts of cultural activities, but the main focus of the social movement was on expanding education to both children and adults. For children, they started hundreds of schools in a very short span of time, a few years that they were in existence. They started hundreds of schools. For adults, they had a kind of multi-pronged approach to trying to increase adult literacy among the poor. They had a textbook that they used, a primer that they used with radio classes. So there would be a radio lesson based on the primer, and there would be monitors in a classroom with actual students, and they would then work through exercises together. But really, anybody with a radio or access to a radio in that primer could study along. And they also had Paulo Freire and his group that were working more with what they would meet with communities. Identify what their kind of cultural language was. And I mean that very much as language, what words were important to them, what defined their work and their culture. And then they would create lessons for literacy based out of that so that the community could learn, adults could participate in these learning groups that were based on their own language and culture in order to learn literacy in different phonetic variations. They were incredibly successful in a very short amount of time, and both types of literacy program were copied and modified not only around Brazil but around the world, that they were picked up in other places. But with the military dictatorship in 1964, they were closed down within 24 hours of the coup. There were military tanks placed on their front garden, and they were their things were destroyed or burned, and many of them went into exile. So that was part.
Situate us in time with that, Courtney, if you would.
Sure. So the movement itself started in 1960, and the military coup was on March 31st to April 1st, 1964.
So much covered here, so many other things we could talk about, Courtney, but we appreciate your time today. Could we wrap up by you telling us a little bit about what you're working on these days?
Sure. I am currently working on I'm always working on too much, but I'll highlight a few things if that's okay. The first is kind of an extension of my interest in Brazilian regionalism, a series of workshops that I worked on with Glenn Goodman out of, formerly out of Urbana-Champaign and now out of Arizona State, called Brazilian Regionalism in a Global Context. And we are putting this together as an edited volume currently, and that is my first priority right now is finishing that up. I am also working on two separate but related book-length, monograph-length projects. The first is Rebellious Women in the Brazilian Nation, and that is focused on on different interpretations and representations of iconic historic Brazilian women in mostly 20th century media and art, and how they're picked up at different moments in time to discuss different issues around nationalism in Brazil and Brazilian national identity. Part of that, kind of a branch off of, a strange branch off of that, was that one of those women is Olga Benário Prestes, who isn't Brazilian, but is kind of adopted as Brazilian. Olga was a German communist Jew. She famously became the bodyguard for Luis Carlos Prestes on his return from the USSR, and helped to support the 1935 communist revolt in Brazil that was ultimately unsuccessful, was deported, pregnant with Prestes' child, to Nazi Germany, where she eventually was murdered in a concentration camp. But her child survived and is still alive. And I'm looking at her story and the story of Prestes as a kind of global history of anti-fascism that I hope unites both Latin American branches of leftist movements and anti-fascism with more European tendencies.
Well, thank you so much, Courtney, for your time today. We'll look forward to the products of that fascinating research. The current book is Region Out of Place, The Brazilian Northeast in the World, 1924 to 1968, University of Pittsburgh Press, 2022. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Latin American Studies.